On Tisha B'Av, we recite many kinos that really have nothing to do with the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash. They are kinos on various tragedies in Jewish history. Amongst them, the Crusades, the martyrs of York, the events of Tach V'Tach, 1648 and 1649 in Poland, the pogroms of Chmielnytskyi. There's a kina about the destruction of the city of Nemirov. And the reason is that Golus and Horban is not just a one-time thing, but it's an ongoing process. In addition, we say that in Pesach. We say tu b'chol dor v'dors in the Haggadah of Pesach. B'chol dor v'dor chayiv adam liros es atzmo ki'ilu hu yotzei mi'mitzrayim. Every generation has in it an aspect of Yetzias Mitzrayim. Every generation has in it the concept of a geula. We are constantly being redeemed on an ongoing process till the final redemption. And every generation has its redemptions, and every individual has his redemptions. Personal redemptions every day. But every generation has its specific redemption. But in order to have a redemption, you have to have the opposite too. And that's why there's another B'chol Dor V'Dor. B'chol Dor V'Dor, Omdim Aleinu L'Chaloseinu. And every generation, they rise up against us to annihilate us. Not a generation goes by without somebody. Whether it's a Hitler or an Arafat or a president of Iran or Hezbollah or Hamas. And that's what they're interested in. They're interested in nothing else than annihilating us. And that's an ongoing thing. The Golus is ongoing. Every generation has its aspect. And the Geula is ongoing. And every generation has its aspect. And therefore, understanding and contemplating the tzaras of past generations, is relevant to Tisha B'Av. So surely, contemplating the tzaras of the present is relevant to Tisha B'Av. And the Navi told us last Shabbos, in Shabbos Chazon, Yeshayahu HaNavi says that you can trace the foundation of the destruction of the Mikdash and our being in Golus to a very simple reason. Yoda shor konehu v'chamor evus bo'alav. An ox knows who it belongs to. It knows its master. And a donkey at least knows who feeds it. Yisrael lo yada, the Jewish people didn't know. They didn't know who they belonged to. They had no hakaras hatov to the Ribbono Shel Olam. They forsook the Ribbono Shel Olam. Even what a donkey knows, they didn't know. Why? Ami lo hisbonan, because they didn't think. What is instinctive to an animal, a human being will miss if he doesn't think, if he doesn't contemplate, if he doesn't ponder. And because we didn't think, all of the messages that God sent us, all of the warnings, were totally ignored. Because if you don't think into something, then it makes no impression on you. And if it makes an impression, you do nothing about it. And we are discussing reward and punishment in this principle of the Rambam. And every single thing that happens in the world is a result of reward and punishment. Nothing is overlooked in this world. Anyone who says that God just overlooks things, and there's no justice, and there's no reward, and there's no punishment, then his inside should be overlooked. It's as much part of nature as a person's entire bodily systems. Nothing's overlooked. Everything happens with precision. And if it doesn't, then the person, Rahman al-Islam, is either sick or he's dead. So the world also, everything happens with precision. And there's cause and there's effect. And there's reward and there's punishment. And it's not only reward and punishment, but the Rabbanu Shalom wants us to be on the right path. And when we stray from that path, then He arouses us, awakens us to that fact. And that's many times the suffering that happens. You have to think into it. Why is it happening? So the result or the cause of everything was Ami lo hisbonon. The people didn't think. And therefore the most simple things escaped them. And the things that should have inspired them and influenced them had no inspiration and no influence. They learned from nothing. And even the mitzvahs and the Torah, when it's done without thinking, becomes mitzvahs anoshim melumada. It becomes things that are done by rote, and you don't benefit what you're supposed to benefit from them. Not only that, you distort them. They themselves become distorted. And that's why it says HaKadosh Baruch Hu was willing to overlook Gilui Arayos, Shfichas Damim, and Avodah Zarah, the three cardinal sins: murder, idolatry, and adultery. But He wasn't willing to overlook Bittul Torah, not learning Torah. Because when you learn Torah, you think. And you have an idea of what to think into other things. So God was willing to temporarily overlook Gilui Arayos, Shfichas Damim, and Avodah Zarah. Had they learned Torah, had they thought, then they would have been influenced and inspired to perhaps repent those sins. But once the people stopped learning Torah, they stopped thinking, then there was nothing to overlook anymore, because God overlooks temporarily, but He doesn't overlook consistently. And if there's no Torah learning, there's no thinking, there's nothing to understand what everything is all about, and not to distort it all, then there's no hope. Then God would have to overlook it consistently and constantly, and then that doesn't happen. So what is this idea of thinking? People don't think, they don't ponder what happens, they don't recognize God, they forget about Him, they don't recognize the good that He does, they don't have any gratitude, they don't recognize the worth of another Jew, of a fellow Jew, and it comes to Sinas Chinam. All the terrible sins that the Jews did can be traced back to not contemplating, not thinking, not pondering. And thinking and pondering has two parts to it, two major parts. And that is the two parts that we're going to discuss right now. One is to see the details, to think about each specific detail, whether it's something that's happening to you, whether it's something you're learning about, what are the details? And then to also think about the meaning of the generality. What do all those details, how do they fit together, and what do they mean as a unit? Some people see the trees, but they fail to realize it's a forest. And some people see the forest, but they fail to see the trees. A Jew, if he's going to be able to assess this world properly, has to see both the forest and the trees. He has to be able not to ignore the details, and at the same time not to get lost in the details and forget to see the overall message. In 2 weeks ago, Sedra, it says that as they left Egypt, Moshe wrote, Motzaehem lemasehem. Their travelings, their going outs according to their journeys. And at the end it says, Ela masehem lemotzaehem. These are their journeys according to their going out. Why they change in order? First it says, Motzaehem lemasehem, and then it says, Masehem lemotzaehem. I think one idea could be the following. As they left Egypt, Moshe Rabbeinu recorded every individual journey. And it was for the sake of teaching the Jewish people what were we supposed to learn from that journey that took us a little bit farther away from what Egypt represented. Each journey took them a little farther out of Egypt, not so much geographically, but spiritually out of Egypt. That was the most difficult thing, because you could take the Jew out of Egypt. It was very difficult to take Egypt out of the Jew. So they went, I didn't make that up, that's the Motzaehem, Lemasehem, therefore means they concentrated on the journeys one by one as they left Egypt. They didn't see the whole picture. They just saw individual details. Each thing was a separate thing by itself. In the end of the 40 years, it was Masehem Lemotzaehem. They put it all together. Now it's not just this journey, the next journey. Now you see the whole pattern. You see it as one unit. You see leaving Egypt and being ready to enter Eretz Israel. There were 42 journeys. And they spanned 40 years. Look at the pattern of the 40 years of every journey and understand the details because of the cloud, because of the general, all-pervasive rule that you've seen over 40 years. So then it was Masehem Lemotzaehem, understanding the details from the entire panorama of history that they experienced. And that's why the 42 journeys represent the 42 letters of God's name of 42 letters. That name you are all familiar with. You may not know that you're familiar with it, but you are familiar with the name of 42 letters because it is contained in the prayer On of the Koach. The first letters of the words of On of the Koach spell out the 42 letter name of God. On of the Koach, Gedulas Yemincha, Tatir Tzrura. Those six letters are the first letters, Aleph, Beis, Gimel, Yud, Tav, Tzadik. Those are the first six letters of that name, and there is a difference of opinion whether the name is 14 combinations of three letters each, or seven combinations of six letters each. But there are 42 letters in that prayer. And each letter starts a word that letter is the beginning of that word. Ona, the Aleph, is the letter from God's name. The Aleph is the beginning of the word Ona. The Beis is the beginning of a letter of God's name. And it begins the word Bekoach, and so on. Now, the fact that it's 42 letters, I think, can hint to the following. 42 is the factor of 7 times 6. And like we said, one of the combinations is 7 combinations of 6 letters. What's the significance of 7 and 6? 7 is the perfection of time. Whenever you have a chunk, a unit of time, that you want to do something in its entirety, it's 7 days. Yom Tovim are 7 days. Avelis is 7 days, Shiva. Chasana, 7 days, Sheva Brachas. Right? Everything is in units of 7 because 7 represents the completion of time because there's 6 days of creation and Shabbos made the unit of time that creation it represents. So 7 is the completion of time. 6 is the completion of space. You wave the lulav to 6 directions, 4 directions up and down. That represents the perfection of place, of space. And that's why a cube has 6 sides to it. That is 6. So 7 times 6 is the perfection of time and place. If we're talking about the totality of time and place, 40 years in the desert, and all the places where they were, so that's represented, the time is represented by 7, the place is represented by 6, and together they're 42. So, therefore, that is a hint to us that you have to look at things both individually all of the details and then see the entire system, the entire process. In last week's Sedra, we have a similar thing. It says that the first sentence in Sefer Devarim, Eila HaDvarim Asher Diber Moshe Kol Yisrael, and it mentions then places, Be'ever HaYardin, Bamidbar, Barava, Mosuf. Each one is a hint to another sin that the Jewish people committed through those 40 years in the desert. And Moshe Rabbeinu only hinted to them the sins out of honor, out of respect for the Jewish people, the Kvodon Shel Yisrael. Because he respected them, he didn't say the sins outright, he only hinted to them. So all the commentaries ask the same obvious question. Later on, Moshe Rabbeinu goes into great detail about most of these sins. In last week's Sedra, he speaks about the sin of the spies. In next week's Sedra, he speaks about the sin of the golden calf. And all the other sins are also gone into great detail. So what did it help to hint to them out of honor to the Jewish people if in the end he was going to go and speak about them in detail and say them outright? So what was this idea? And also, if you look at the names of the places that he mentioned, the hymns, they don't follow any chronological order. It wasn't the sins that they committed when they left Egypt, and then the ones after that, and after that. It's totally no order to it, seemingly. So what I want to say is the following. Moshe Rabbeinu rebuked the Jewish people for each individual sin throughout the book of Devarim. That is one aspect of Mussar and Tochacha. But in the beginning, he gave them the respect that they were capable of thinking and seeing a pattern. It wasn't just each individual sin. They couldn't just look at the trees. But over 40 years, they committed many sins. And if you put them all together, then there's a pattern that you have to deal with that pattern. You can't just look at the individual things, because the individual things can be misleading. You can have excuses. You can have reasons for this or this or this, but when you put them all together, doesn't wash. It's not anymore an excuse, as I'll explain to you in a second. And therefore, you have to see the pattern, and when you contemplate the pattern, the totality, then you have a much more honest approach to what it was. You can't just look at it as a yotzim in a cloud, like something that's an aberration, that's an exception to the rule. You see what the rule looks like. And then you're able to deal with it in a proper way and repent and learn the lesson, whatever. Let me now show you how the order that Moshe Rabbeinu gave, in my estimation, is unbelievable of what it hints to, the idea that you can't look at each thing separately. Start with the first one. The first one was Bamidbar. The sins that they committed when they first went into the desert, and they complained, and they had doubts whether God was going to provide them water and food in the desert. So they complained against God in the desert. Okay, so that would be the only sin, and you'd look at that only as a separate, disjointed thing. You would say, okay, look, you can understand. People go into the desert. They don't have any obvious support, and they panic. And a person is not really held responsible for things that he says under panic. Very good. What's the next thing? Ba'arava. When you left the desert and you were in the plains, you were already out of that panic situation of the desert. You also sinned by the daughters of Moab. So if the only excuse is that we were under a panic situation in the desert, why'd you sin when you got out of the desert? Molsuf. Molsuf, says Rashi, hints to two things. The sins they committed before the splitting of the Red Sea, at the banks of the Red Sea, where they again complained about God and wanted to go back to Egypt, and the sins after the splitting of the Red Sea, where they also said that there was no water and they complained, God took us out here to kill us. Again, before the splitting of the Red Sea, the Egyptians were at their heels, the sea was in front of them, they panicked. If that would be the only sin, okay. But you sinned right after the splitting of the Red Sea. You saw the miracle. You saw how God miraculously took care of you. Then it's no more excuse of what you did before because you panicked, because you sin even when you don't panic. After you've seen terrible, tremendous miracles, you still sin. Vein Paran uvein Tofel v'lava. Rashi says, Paran hints to the place where they sent the spies. Tofel and lava is the sin that they committed by complaining about the man. Think about it. One of the ideas of why they sent the spies and why they didn't want to go into Eretz Israel is because they got so used to living a miraculous life in the desert, they were afraid of living a natural life in Eretz Israel. Okay, I understand that. But then what are you complaining about the man? The man is miraculous. If you like miracles and you don't like nature, then you should like the man. So why are you complaining about the man then? And then the last two things is the Chatzeros v'Dizahav. In Chatzeros was the machlokus of Korach. Korach's rebellion against Moshe. And Dizahav is the sin of the golden calf. Again, it's totally out of order. But what's the lesson? You know why Korach rebelled against Moshe? Because they didn't realize how important Moshe Rabbeinu was. What do we need leaders for? Everybody's holy. It was a not understanding the importance of a leader, the importance of Moshe Rabbeinu. Okay. So they made a mistake. What was the sin of the golden calf? That Moshe Rabbeinu is gone, and they panicked. We can't exist without a Moshe Rabbeinu. That was putting too much importance to Moshe Rabbeinu. So which is it? You don't think he's important, you think he's too important. Put all these things together, and all of the excuses for any one single one doesn't hold anymore. You have to look beyond it and see what the pattern is and how to deal with it. That is the idea. And Moshe Rabbeinu had the honor, respect of Klal Yisrael that they'd be able to take the hint and be able to see the total picture, put it all together, not just deal with each sin as a separate entity. They would be able to see the forest, not just the trees. And the truth is that this is not only between man and God, between man and man also. If you can't see the whole picture, then many times you distort things. And that's how you come to speak Lashon Hara and to hate people, and that's what destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. It says, "Have Eidonis Kol HaAdam L'Katzvus." You should judge, the way it's usually translated, all human beings favorably. That can't mean that. That's not true. Halachically, you're not allowed to judge a Rasha favorably. A wicked person, you can't give him the benefit of the doubt. You have to assume that he did something bad. Can't give him the benefit of the doubt. Average people, you only have to give the benefit of the doubt in normal, probable situations. For instance, if you see someone walk into a trade restaurant, an average person, who's a frum person, an average Shomer Torah mitzvahs, you see him walk into a trade restaurant, you see nothing more. So it would be logical and reasonable, that's what I'm looking for, reasonable, to assume that he went in to use the bathroom. He went in to buy a Coke. Okay? You have to give him the benefit of the doubt. He didn't go in to eat trade. But what if you see him sitting there munching on a pork chop? Well, you could still judge him favorably. He had some kind of attack of amnesia. He doesn't know who he is. Or he had some kind of medical problem, and his doctor said that if he gets this attack, he must eat immediately the first thing that he can eat. It's pikuach nefesh. Could be, but you don't have to give the person the benefit of the doubt. That's unreasonable for an average person. If you would have seen Rav Moshe Feinstein's outside eating a pork chop in a trade restaurant, you would have had to assume that he had some kind of attack, and this is pikuach nefesh. Right? You'd have to give him some benefit of the doubt, even if it's unreasonable. So it's not true that you have to judge every person favorably. There are different gradations, sometimes yes, sometimes not. Therefore, some say it doesn't mean judge every person favorably. It means judge the whole person, call ha'adam, the entire person favorably. Meaning if you only hone in on details, no one does not have details that are negative. And in fact, if you just look at details, you can always find something negative. Because I'll say, kol hashkafa shebamikra l'ra'ah, chutz mehashkifa mema'on kachicha. Hashkafa means you look from above and you circle in on one specific thing. You're going to always find negative things in everybody. But if you look at the entire person, you see their good points. You see their circumstances. You see their mitigating circumstances. That's why it says, don't judge someone until you come to their place. Understand the environment that surrounds them. What brought them to do this? Maybe they're not such bad people. But if you understand their past, their home life, the circumstances of their life, then you'll understand that they're mitigating circumstances. They're not doing this because they're terrible people. They're doing it because this is a factor and that's a factor. If you look at the whole person and his whole surrounding circumstances, then you'll be able to judge people favorably. And then you will come less to speak lashon hara about people and less to hate them. And that was the aveiros that destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. This also applies when tsaros happen. When tsaros occur, so we are told what to do. You're not supposed to just say, oh, it's terrible politically, and read all the newspapers and find out the political and military and social, economic causes of why this happened, right? But all of those things are results. They're not the causes. The causes are that something's wrong spiritually, and it has to be corrected. And when it happens and affects one person, then that one person has to make a cheshbon ha-nefesh. He has to, we'll see in one second, examine his deeds and see what he can correct and what he can strengthen and what he can better to change his spiritual condition so his physical condition will change. Because physical conditions are the result of spiritual conditions. And when the spiritual condition is not all right, then the physical condition is not all right. And when it happens to a cloud, to a tzibur, then the tzibur has to make a cheshbon ha-nefesh, and every individual in the tzibur has to make a cheshbon, because we're all part of that cloud. Whether it's affecting us directly or not, it's affecting us as a people. And we all are part of that people. So we are being affected. Somebody, Rahman al-Son, is sick, and he has a head injury, and he's in the hospital, so his feet and toes don't say, oh, we're fine. Just poor guy has a head problem. No, that poor guy is you. Your feet have the same problem. They're connected to a head that had a trauma that's in the hospital. It's not just your head's in the hospital, your feet in the hospital too. Because your whole body is affected. So we may not be affected directly, but we are definitely part of that body of cloud as well as being affected. So what are you supposed to do when tsaros befall you? As now, a tzara hiliyako. This is a tzara. It's a time of calamity, tragedy for Klal Yisrael. We're in a war. Nothing less than that. So what are you supposed to do? So Chazal said, Yifashpesh b'maisav uyimashmesh b'maisav. Person should examine his deeds. Now the Mesil Shisharim says, what's the two kinds of examination? Yifashpesh means to see if you've done anything wrong that you can correct. And yamashmesh means see the things that you've done that are good, can you do them better? That they need correction and fine-tuning. I have a different shot, which I think can also be true. Yifashpesh means look at the details. Look at the individual things that you've done. And see if you can correct, strengthen the details. But that doesn't end there. And how does Yifashpesh mean that? In the Beis HaMikdash, there were little entrances, almost like keyholes sometimes, little windows that were called Pishpishim. Pishpish is a small opening. When you look through a keyhole, you see only details. You don't see the whole picture. You can focus in on small things. So yafash face means look through the keyhole and examine each individual thing and see if there's place for improvement, correction, and so on. But don't stop there. Then you mashmish b'maisa. Pick up those individual things and look what caused them. What's the bigger picture? Don't only look at that one divorced individual action, but what kind of mitos, what kind of character do you have that led you to do that action? What kind of outlook and Torah perspective do you have that led you to do that action? Maybe your beliefs, maybe your standards, your values are the problem, and because of that you did that specific thing. Maybe because your personality and your character isn't what it should be, that led you to do that one specific thing. So look at the specifics, but then look at the pattern, and look at the causes behind them, so you see the bigger picture. You see that it's not just this or that or the other thing, where I could have excuses, but it's a pattern. And I can't just rely on those excuses. I have to see what the bigger picture is. And maybe it involves more than just the individual things. And the truth is that that is the mitzvah tzitzis shows that. Tzitzis, you have to see each individual mitzvah, the strings, but you have to realize that they're all tied together. They all form one group. And then those groups are tied to a talus which envelops you as one unit. So you have to be able to see each individual thing, see that they're connected, and see that they're all one pattern also, ultimately. They go from individual strings to knotted to the whole beged that envelops you. And that's why the tzitzis hint to 613. When you see them, you'll remember 613 mitzvahs. The chorev, when you see the tzitzis, you don't have to remember 613 mitzvahs. You only have to remember 612, because the tzitzis are there. They're one of them. But the answer is, you can see tzitzis as a separate mitzvah, or you can see it as part of the totality. When you look at the tzitzis, you have to see all 613. You have to see the totality, not just 612 separate things. Now, in this chazal that says that when you see tzoras coming upon you, you should look at the details and then look at the pattern. So there must be two variant readings to this chazal, because I've seen so many people fulfill these other variant readings as opposed to what it says in my Gemara, that they must have some source that reads it differently. But I've looked and I haven't found any variant source. So they must be making a mistake. But one variant source is obviously not yafash beish b'maisa, b'yamash beish b'maisa. Examine your deeds, but yafash beish b'mezuzosa. Examine your mezuzas. When you see tzaras coming, check your mezuzas. Now that is not, again, I don't want to denigrate checking mezuzas if they're tzaras. Right? That may be something you should do, and it's obviously big people who also say you should check your mezuzas. But they don't mean to tell you to blame the mezuzah for your tzoras. Right? Oh, I know what happened. That stupid mezuzah on the door, right? Terrible mezuzah, and therefore it caused all my tzoras. The mezuzah doesn't do anything. It just hangs there all day. Right? It never does anything wrong. Maybe the mezuzah is a sign that there's something wrong with you, and then you should find out what that is. But don't blame the mezuzah. I remember the Rav Shach Zatzal, in a machlokus that he had with another Adam Gadol. So he said something very sharp. And when this other person heard what he had said, he said, if a shach could say something like that, maybe he should check his tefillin shorosh. He should check his head tefillin. Maybe something's wrong with the tefillin, and that's what made him say what he said. So when a shach heard this, he laughed. And he said, you want to say that I said something wrong, something wrong with me, I can accept Musa. But don't blame my tefillin. My tefillin really do nothing. They sit in a bag all day, right? They were written by a fine sofer. They're Kodesh, right? They sit on my head. My tefillin, I've never seen them do any aveiras. Why blame my poor tefillin? So, The first line of action when you have tzaras is not to check your mezuzahs. It's to check yourself. And if you want to check your mezuzahs to see, maybe you'll find a hint of what to check in yourself, okay. But don't blame the mezuzahs. The second variant reading is not yifashpeis b'maisa, check your deeds, but yifashpeis b'maaseya, check other people's deeds. Blame them, right? It's obviously not your fault, you're a tzaddik. Right? If they're tzaras and Klal Yisrael, it's obviously those people's fault. And true to life, I've seen something that I saw, somebody sent me, that all of this is to whose blame? The people who wanted to make that parade in Yerushalayim. Now, I obviously do not condone the parade. Okay? That's an understatement. Okay? And I don't condone what those people stand for. But that's not what Chazal said. Blame somebody else. Chazal said, look into yourself and see what you can correct, not what you can correct other people. And the proof to that, my Rosh Yeshiva of Boros Saratskin said the name of his father, of Zalman Saratskin, is the case of Yonah. Yonah HaNavi was a tzaddik. He had one little sin. He was holding back a prophecy to go to Nineveh and warn the Assyrians that if they didn't do tshuva, they'd be destroyed in 40 days. And he did that to Shem Shamayim, because the Assyrians were the arch enemies of the Jewish people. They were the Hezbollah and the Hamas of their time, the Iran, Syria. Imagine if God came to you last night and he said to you, go and warn the Iranians, the Syrians, the Palestinians, that if they don't do tshuva in 40 days, they are going to be wiped off the map. Right? Wouldn't you find something to do for 41 days? There's only one problem. If you hold back your prophecy, you're liable to a death penalty. So Yonah said, you know what? I'm willing to sacrifice my life for the Jewish people. Let the Assyrians be wiped off the map. Right? I'm not going to tell them. I will incur a spiritual death penalty. I'm willing to sacrifice my life for the Jewish people. That was his only sin. Now he's on this boat, running away, so he doesn't have to prophesy. And the boat is in danger of sinking. And there are 70 goyim on this boat, each one a different idol worshiper, and they're all worshiping their idols on the spot, trying to save the boat. And nothing's working. So the captain remembers there's a 71st guy aboard here. He looks for him. He finds Yonah sleeping underneath the boat, down below. And he wakes him up and he says, you know, look, there's 70 people on board who are serving their idols and trying to save the boat. Nothing's happening. Maybe you have a 71st God that you can pray to. Now, if I was Yonah, I would say, well, you see all those people parading on the deck, each one doing their idol worship? Go blame them. I'm a Navi. I'm God's prophet. I'm a tzaddik. Don't blame me. I didn't do anything wrong. And what does Yonah say? It's not them, it's me. Because God expects more from Yonah the prophet than he expects from a bunch of 70 clowns parading on the... These people have no idea what they're doing. They're lost souls. So the Rabban Hashem does not expect too much from them. But he expects a lot more from people who know better. So if there's tzaras and Klal Yisrael, don't blame the 70 idol worshippers. Don't blame the leftists and the secularists or whatever. Blame yourself. We know better. So maybe the little sins that we have are much greater in God's eyes than the big sins that other people have who don't really know what they're doing anyway, who are totally estranged. That's what yifashpeish b'maisav and yimashpeish b'maisav means. And so how do you know? How do you know what to look for? So you need a Navi, really, to tell you, you know, what your sins are, what the sins of the Klal are. But I'll tell you, without being a Navi, and I've not heard from Gedolei Yisrael what they have to say, they're even greater than the Navi, but I haven't heard. But I'm going to tell you something the Chafetz Chaim says that makes it a little bit easier to know what to examine. And examine, again, as individual things and as a pattern. And that is the following. The Chafetz Chaim says that when Jews don't appreciate what they have and therefore don't use it properly or don't relate to it properly, then the Ribono Shel Olam sometimes takes it away from us or threatens to have it taken away and makes it vulnerable, threatened. And that's a foolproof method for appreciating something that you never appreciated. Unfortunately, people appreciate their parents most when they're no longer here. When they're here, you know, they take them for granted. When you have something, you take it for granted. When it's threatened to be taken away, then you begin to appreciate it. And that's one of the reasons why the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. When it was here, we didn't appreciate it. We took it for granted. We sinned, even though we had this tremendous supposed place of connection to God, and we lulled ourselves into thinking that everything's fine. We have a Beis HaMikdash, we make sacrifices, we're great people. And we didn't realize that underneath all of that, things were rotten, but it looked good. So the Ribono Shel Olam took away the Beis HaMikdash. And for 2,000 years, we've been praying daily, three times a day, to get it back. Maybe we'll appreciate it when we get it back. Because we've gone through 2,000 years of wanting it back. So maybe we've learned over 2,000 years to appreciate it. So maybe the Ribono Shel Olam will give it back to us soon. If he knows that when we get it back, we'll appreciate it. So the same thing goes with any tzara. It would seem from this that if you can see what the tzara threatens, what it took away, then you can understand what you need to work on, what you need to contemplate, what you need to examine and consider. So let's see what this tzara entails. And there are basically four things, even though I can go into much more detail, which I plan to do on Tisha B'Av where I live, but there are four basic things. This tzara started with one Jewish boy being captured, kidnapped, and then two more were still in being held as hostages. That teaches me that freedom is being threatened, freedom of these individuals, and it should make me appreciate my freedom a lot more, because I was made aware and had to suffer because somebody else's freedom was taken away. Secondly, that's a sorrow of three individuals. Everybody should feel that sorrow. So freedom is in jeopardy. Second thing is families. Here are three young men who are torn away from their families. Can you imagine how the families feel? They don't even know if they're alive or not alive. They have no idea what's going on with their children. They're in the hands of animals, worse than animals. Animals is a covet for these people. They're worse than animals. Animals at least do what they're supposed to do. And they have a certain code of the jungle. These people have no code of anything. They're worse than animals. And these young men are in their hands. Do you know what their families feel like? Families torn apart. So the family is in jeopardy. So you have to understand and feel, do we appreciate families properly? Do we relate to our family members, whether it's parents to children or children to parents or siblings to each other or parents to each other? All the various family relationships. The third thing is life is in danger. Their lives and the lives of hundreds and thousands of other Jews who don't know if a rocket is going to come out of the sky and destroy their house and destroy their lives. So life is in jeopardy. Jewish life. And last, but not least, Eretz Yisrael is in jeopardy. We have people who want to take a little bit away from this side and a little bit away from that side and a lot away from the middle and leave us with nothing. They don't want a state. They want our state. They want everything. Anybody who still has illusions that the Palestinians will be happy with a state of their own have to be out of their mind. They can hear Paris talking like a rightist hawk lately. And he is out of his mind. So something has woken him up a little bit too. Anybody who thinks that they just want, you know, a new Middle East where they'll be able to live in peace or whatever, they want our blood. That's what they want. Nothing less than that. They want to throw us into the sea. That's what they are. They are wild animals. And again, that is a covet to call them an animal. And I thought it doesn't apply to every single Arab. But we're talking now as a group. These are the people, they voted for the Hamas, so why shouldn't they suffer along with them? This is what you want. These are the people that you populate yourself amongst. You let them hide amongst you. So we should be afraid of killing innocent, there's no innocent people there. They're killing their own children by putting them around terrorists. Our hands should be tied that our families, our innocent people, who are really innocent people, should be hurt because we don't want to hurt people who are sheltering and being human shields to terrorists, whether it's the Hamas or it's the Hezbollah. These people in Lebanon show their support for them. They hold from them. They let them put rockets in their houses. They let them shoot them from their pipeline. So then you're also part of this war. And you'll suffer just as much as anybody else. You're not innocent people. Even the children are not innocent. Their parents are responsible. If they put their children as human shields to terrorists, then those children will be killed. It's not our fault, it's their fault. And that we have to apologize to nations of the world is absurd. Not as absurd, but that's the world we live in. When they do to us, Kofi Annan, the name is really a great name, Kofi. That's what he is, a monkey. He feels terrible after the protest, but we kill innocent people. And does he remember how this all started? Did he say anything? Huh?
They put
their children. Yeah, for sure. They use their children as shields for themselves. So fine, so then that's what they want, that's what they'll get. I have to worry about killing their children, and better they should kill my children because of that? Ridiculous thing. But these are all anti-Semites. They hate Yidden and then every chance they can get, whether it makes sense or doesn't make sense, that's what they say. So here, the head of the United Nations is one big ape. Kofi. There's something in the name. And that's the world. That's the world. And I'm sure that the Americans are hoping that we won't stop. They kind of that they're forbidding us to stop. We're doing their dirty work. They know what it's all about. They get the same Narishkeit in Iraq. But we get it worse because they hate us more. So Eretz Israel is in danger. Those are the four things. Life, family, freedom, Eretz Israel. And you can look at each one separately. Do we appreciate life as we should? Do we lead our lives and show that we appreciate every moment? Do we appreciate Eretz Yisrael? Do we want it as much as they want it? Are we willing to sacrifice for it as much as they are? And you have to think about that, because it says that the city of Vermaisa was destroyed twice during the Crusades. And the scarring bring down that the Shmar, the Yeshua folk, who lived in the 1600s, said that the reason was that when Ezra went back to build the Beis HaMikdash, he invited all the communities that existed at the time to come back and help him build the Beis HaMikdash and resettle Eretz Israel. And the city of Vermaisa, which had been around since the destruction of the first temple, and some say even before, said, we have our beautiful shul, our little Mikdash, we have our little Yerushalayim, and we're happy here. We're not going to go with you to Eretz Israel, but we'll support you. Now, we're proud of what you're doing, but we'll stay here. And because they didn't go, the city was destroyed twice during the Crusades. It always bothered me, the Crusades were 1,000 years after this. Right? Why then? I was thinking because the Crusades were Christians who were upset that the infidel Muslims had taken over Yerushalayim, and that was the supposed reason for the Crusades, right, was to liberate the holy city. When Goyim appreciate Eretz Yisrael, then Yidden who don't appreciate it, that's what happens. And somebody asked me, well, what about today? When the Yidden who don't appreciate Eretz Yisrael and there's Goyim who are blowing themselves to bits for the sake of Eretz Yisrael. And then I saw in the newspaper that week, this was a few years ago, that the cemetery in Vermeisa had been vandalized. Because there are no more Jews in Worms, in Vermeisa. There's dead Jews. So when Arabs are blowing themselves up for the sake of Eretz Yisrael, there has to be something that is negative about Jews who weren't interested in Eretz Yisrael. So, do we appreciate that? Do we appreciate our freedom? Do we use the freedom properly to redouble our efforts to serve the Rabbanu Shalom, or to use it to be free from the Rabbanu Shalom? Families, do we appreciate our family relationships? Can we appreciate how these families feel now? Right, all the narishkeit, you know, and this complaint, or that complaint, or this family feud, or that. When somebody's torn away, all these things melt into nothingness. So each thing is separate, but the truth is they all have one common thing to them. Eretz Yisrael is called Eretz Achaim. It's the land where you can really get a perspective on life. And life is not just for the here and now. It's for what is eternal. And the whole concept of family is that this is what creates the standards and the values and the environment where you can live a life like that. If you have the right family environment, the right family standards and values. And Eretz Yisrael is the place that all of that can come to together. So all of these things, freedom, life, Eretz Yisrael, and family, have a pattern to it. So it's not enough just to think about the individual things, but think about them as a pattern together. And if all of us, take the time out, especially over the next few days and through Tisha B'Av, of thinking about these things, then and seeing how we personally can correct and improve and strengthen them, then Amir Tzashem, we will have learned from this Tzara the things that the Rebbe Shalom, at least on the surface, wants us to learn, and then the Tzara will go away, not only go away, but the situation will be corrected to a point where we'll be able to have all of those things and more when the Rebbe Shalom will send Mashiach and build us the third base on it.